This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Chances are the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the phrase water quality is nitrogen. Nitrogen is a critical component of fertilizer. It's basically plant food, which is not inherently bad, but as we all know here on Cape Cod, you can have too much of a good thing. Excess nitrogen from septic systems makes its way into coastal ponds and bays around Cape Cod, causing algal blooms and fish kills. Over the past several years, researchers have also found a number of other chemicals that can be traced back to our wastewater, from medicines to cosmetics and household cleaners. And as you'll hear today, nitrogen may be one of the best ways we have to track those chemicals. Joining me this morning, Laurel Shader is a research scientist at Silent Spring Institute. Tom Camberari is Watershed Management Director for the Cape Cod Commission, and Amy Costa is Director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Now, Laurel, can you just, first of all, define this umbrella term, contaminants of emerging concern? What does that encompass?
Sure. So contaminants of emerging concern or emerging contaminants are chemicals that are not currently regulated in drinking water, but are of concern because of potential human or ecological health effects. There isn't really a set list of what's considered an emerging contaminant, but we typically think of things like pharmaceuticals, hormones, chemicals in consumer products like fragrances, flame retardants, basically chemicals that are in our daily lives that end up in the wastewater that we put down our sinks and toilets and drains.
Well, and when you say these, there's two different phrases, right? The contaminants of emerging concern or emerging contaminants. But which one is the new or emerging part? The fact that the chemicals are there or the fact that we're worried about them?
So there are, in some cases, there are chemicals that are truly emerging and that they're new chemicals or that they're becoming used much more widely. But in many cases, it's really our awareness of the presence of these chemicals that are emerging. In the recent two decades, there have been improvements in analytical techniques for measuring emerging contaminants. And we've been able to measure these chemicals at the parts per trillion levels that are typically found in environmental waters. So I think of this as analogous to improvements in telescope technology. So as telescopes improved, we learned a lot more about the stars that were there all along, but we weren't able to see them before.
So talk a little bit more about the levels that you do find. You've looked in wastewater, in groundwater, in ponds around Cape Cod. What kind of levels are we talking about, and how much does it vary from place to place?
So the levels that we find in drinking water and ponds are typically in the parts per trillion levels, or nanograms per liter. We've been testing drinking water and ponds, and we've found chemicals like pharmaceuticals and consumer product chemicals in many of the locations that we've tested. And we do see quite a range in terms of the concentrations we find. If you're looking at ponds that are in more pristine areas or drinking water wells where there's no development, we really don't see these chemicals showing up. But if you're looking in areas with more residential development, more septic systems, more commercial activity, that's where we see the highest levels.
Amy Costa, you've been looking for some of these contaminants in coastal waters. Does the same thing carry there? Are we seeing these low levels and fairly widespread distribution of these kinds of chemicals?
Yes, we are. We are seeing in most of the sites that we have tested, we have found at least one of the contaminants that we've tested for. But we do tend to target areas that we think they're going to occur. So we haven't really broadened our research to look at low impact sites yet. That's on the horizon, we hope.
And Tom, what about drinking water? As Laurel mentioned, drinking water wells, groundwater, an issue here on the Cape. How much monitoring, if at all, is there for these kinds of chemicals?
Well, there's a program that is being implemented through the EPA. It's called the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. And as Laurel said, these are compounds of emerging concern. And even the federal EPA and state agencies and even on here on Cape Cod, we have a difficulty saying, well, where are these and how much of a concern is it? And so the UCMR program at EPA has tested water supplies nationally. So it's become a program that's testing the waters across the nation to find out its occurrence and its detections. And it was imperative for water suppliers that have more than 10,000 connections to do that. And so there's 18 water purveyors on Cape Cod that provide our water from our sole source aquifer. And I guess about 8 of these had to do testing for these unregulated compounds. And so that between that and Silent Spring and testing up at the MMR, that's the extent of monitoring and giving us an idea of the occurrence of these compounds. And I think we're basically at the tip of the iceberg on knowing where they are. It's always been my contention and scientists that you need to know what you're dealing with before you can really take effective management solutions. So we are kind of at the tip of the iceberg. We know these compounds are, as Laurel said, in the ponds. We also know that there are some high occurrences in some water supplies on the Cape.
Laurel, how much of a concern is the occurrence of things like pharmaceuticals or personal care products? I mean, these are not things that we really perhaps want to be drinking if we just think about it in those terms. But as you said, they're very low, low concentrations. How much of a concern is it for human health? How much science do we have to back up any concerns we might have?
Well, we do have more information about the potential health effects of these chemicals in ecosystems. It's much easier to study fish or other aquatic organisms over their lifespan. And there have been concerns and instances where fish downstream of wastewater treatment plants show signs of endocrine disruption. So male fish that are actually laying eggs, and you can imagine that affects their ability to sustain their populations. In terms of human health effects, our understanding is really emerging, and I'd say that our knowledge varies quite a bit depending about which specific class of chemicals that you're talking about. So in the case of pharmaceuticals, the level of exposure that you'd have from drinking water with traces of pharmaceuticals is much, much lower than a therapeutic dose. However, the presence of pharmaceuticals in drinking water still does raise some health concerns. We know that we don't give medications to pregnant women or children because we know that their bodies are more sensitive to the effects. We know that sensitivity varies among individuals. So, for instance, some people are very sensitive to antibiotics. And we're learning more and more about the potential endocrine disruption effects. So these are hormone-mimicking chemicals. And in some cases, we see greater effects at lower levels than at higher levels. For some of the other classes of chemicals, such as flame retardants or fluorinated chemicals, these are in nonstick and stain-resistant products, we have some information both from animal studies and epidemiological studies, so studies of human populations where, say, the drinking water supply is contaminated. And some of these have been associated with cancer, hormone disruption, and developmental toxicity at higher levels of exposure. So their presence in drinking water, particularly in mixtures, is certainly of concern.
I mean, that's a lot of different ranges, a lot of different concerns. Bottom line, someone hearing about this for the first time, should they be thinking, oh my, I've got to really change what I'm doing for drinking water. I've got to be talking to officials. I've got to be changing things. Or should this just be something to maybe keep on the radar, keep an eye on, keep an ear on for a while?
I think it's definitely something that people should keep their eye on. And I think it's a great idea for people to learn more about where their water comes from. So people who rely on town water can learn more about where the wells in their town are located, what are the potential pollution threats. For people that rely on private wells, and about 20% of Cape residents have a private well, they're really on their own in terms of monitoring their water quality over time. So we do recommend that people who have a private well get their water tested.
Tom, you're nodding along here. Would you agree in terms of the level of concern that you think is justified about this issue?
Yeah, I think that, yes, the level of concern is justified. As Laurel said, I think it's prudent for anybody to find out what information there is about the quality of their water. We do have some information, as I said, through the uncontaminated monitoring rule. And I think it's I think we have there's some distinctions that we need to bear in mind as well is drinking water's been a long time issue for folks here on Cape Cod, because of our sole source aquifer. And you mentioned the issue of nitrogen, and that's how I started my career, is trying to manage nitrogen inputs, and particularly for the protection of drinking water. So a variety of actions have been taken, programs have been developed, institutional management regulations to protect water from our land uses. And I think one of the biggest things that we've done is, working with the towns and the water districts and the land trusts, and like the Cape Cod Compact, is protecting our pristine areas that we get our water supplies from. So there is a distinction when we look at all those efforts combined, that we look to maintain a sustainable supply of high-quality, untreated drinking water, is where are all those wells that are very well protected, and probably about 60% of our water supplies, and we have maybe about 260 gravel-pack wells across the Cape serving 30 million gallons of water a day to us. Those are very well protected, and then there's a handful of wells that are more susceptible, probably the wells that were put in our early stages of development in high-density residential areas, in the 50s and 60s, that are more problematic. And I think from some of the testing that has been done, we're aware of that, and there are some actions being taken now to deal with it.
Amy, what about the environmental impacts? As Laurel mentioned, evidence of fish being affected downstream of wastewater treatment plants in some environments. Is that something that is being looked at here on the Cape or in the waters around us?
So far at the center, we've just concentrated on water and looking at levels of contaminants of emerging concern in the coastal waters. We've started looking a little bit at oysters and shellfish because they do filter so much water a day and would be one of the first places we would assume to concentrate these contaminants. But other work further up the food web, we haven't looked at that.
Laurel, you mentioned fluorinated compounds, flame retardants. This is an area that your research and Silent Spring Institute has been looking into more recently. Talk a little bit about how something like a flame retardant ends up in our wastewater and then out in the environment.
So fluorinated chemicals, they're also called perfluorinated chemicals or PFASs, are used in many household products. So they're found in nonstick frying pans, fast food packaging, waterproof clothing, stain-resistant coatings on carpets and furniture, in waterproof apparel, even in certain dental flosses. So it's easy to think about pathways that these could get into our wastewater, say from laundering clothes that are treated, or from mopping up floors in homes where these stain-resistant chemicals are added to carpets. So we, in our drinking water studies, tested for perfluorinated chemicals, and we did find them in many of the wells that we tested.
Now, particularly tests in Hyannis revealed levels of these chemicals that were above the EPA's health guidelines. Tom, can you talk a little bit about what happened from there, knowing that this level was too high? What steps have been taken? What kind of monitoring is in place?
Yeah, I can give you a little snapshot. It was the Silent Spring work that was done, in the in Laurel's work that gave us a report back in 2009 that there was the presence of some of these CECs, compounds of emerging concern, in water supplies. And as I said, there are a handful of these that are in more high-density residential areas. And it turned out that Laurel's work identified some wells in the Hyannis area that had concentrations of perfluorinated compounds in fairly high concentrations. And so at that time, it took a period to for this work, for this knowledge, to transcend the academic world and get into the EPA program, that laboratories, you know, got geared up to be able to provide these analysis. So one of the sources of perfluorinated compounds is AFFF, which is a aqueous film forming foam, which is used ubiquitously across the country in firefighting operations.
So that's the foam that they're actually spraying to put out the fire.
That's right. That's right. And manufactured by 3M, developed in cooperation with the Navy to help put out petroleum-based flames. So anywhere you see a petroleum-based flame, you don't pour water on it because that just moves it around. So they developed this compound so it would basically smother the fire. So if you're on an aircraft carrier, smothers the fire. If you've got aircraft coming down, you can deal with it. And then also, it's a water saver. It was adopted as a water saver as well for firefighting purposes. So it turns out that the concentration of perfluorinated compounds was rather high, and the compound, geez, Laura, when was it the 3M stopped making it? Was it 2009, I believe?
2002, 3M phased out the production of PFOS, sorry. And then EPA has a stewardship plan that went into effect in 2006 to phase out the production of PFOA in the U.S.
And yet these are the compounds
still being...
You've been finding these compounds in Hyannis drinking water much more recently than that, yes?
Yes, they have been. And so this foam is, although it's stopped production, it's still on the shelves. It's still available. It's still being used. There's some very high-level discussions going on with the state fire marshal and the environmental folks up in Boston about the situation of this these compounds. So No, there was a fire training academy in Hyannis, and based upon Laurel's work, there was a recommendation to cease the use of these foams for fire training purposes at the site. And as we geared up to do some monitoring, what did we find? Well, we did find these perfluorinated compounds at the site. And the UCMR data also corroborated the findings of Silent Spring in 2013, found some concentrations also. So in the meantime, there's been a number of actions that the county has undertaken, a very aggressive assessment of the extent, nature, vertical extent of contamination in groundwater. They've also put in a pump and treat system. So right now they're pumping out some of the highest concentrations at the site, treating it and putting it back into the groundwater clean. The town of Barnstable has undertaken a variety of very aggressive responses and putting carbon filtration on two of the down gradient water supply wells. And also there's another compound that's out there as well. That's one for dioxane, and that's another compound of emerging concern that has an MCL on it, or maximum contaminant. It's a regulated compound. It's under the Massachusetts Contingency Plan, and that is also being dealt with in the Hyannis area by hooking up to the town of Yarmouth and blending this water, so it gets below these standards. And also, you know, Laurel mentioned private wells, and private wells are a situation up in Eastham, Amy's hometown, that I guess, Amy, now you will be paying for water supply infrastructure.
Yes, it's a good thing.
Well, and we will talk more about that infrastructure and what needs to be done across the Cape to deal with these issues. That's Tom Camberry, also Laurel Shader and Amy Costa. I'm Heather Goldstone. More conversation about emerging contaminants in Cape Cod water when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about a diverse group of chemicals known by a somewhat obscure name, contaminants of emerging concern. That broad umbrella covers everything from medicines to cosmetics, household cleaners, nonstick lining of your skillets, and, as we were just hearing, the foam that firefighters use to put out fires. As welcome as many of these things may be in our morning routines and daily lives, they're less desirable in our drinking water or our coastal bays. So how do we track them, and what do we do about them? Amy Costa is director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies. Laurel Shader is a research scientist at Silent Spring Institute. And Tom Cambereri is watershed management director for the Cape Cod Commission. Tom, we were talking about this situation in Hyannis with the fluorinated compounds that are flame retardants and nonstick components. And you were talking about all the different actions taken to try to reduce those levels in drinking water. Has it worked? Is the water back to being below levels of concern?
We had a meeting just last week, and as the information that that was discussed was the treatment at the well fields, and as well as the blending, has worked, has been effective to reduce those levels.
You're listening to Living Lab. We're talking about water quality on the Cape, and we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Laurel, we're used to hearing about nitrogen as a water quality problem, essentially excess fertilizer going into environmental waters. But some of the research that you've been doing is showing that we may be actually able to use that nitrogen to figure out where some of these other contaminants are. How much can nitrogen tell us about what else is in our wastewater and our drinking water?
That's right. So nitrogen pollution is a problem for coastal water quality. And the main source of that nitrogen pollution is septic systems, and mainly from human waste as the main source of nitrogen. So where we see areas where groundwater contains elevated levels of nitrogen, it's not a surprise that we also see elevated levels of pharmaceuticals and consumer product chemicals that are in that same septic system water. So we did a study of ponds on the Cape back in 2008, where we compared several ponds in more densely developed areas and less densely developed areas. And not surprisingly, the ponds with higher levels of nitrate that also had more development around them had more frequent detections of pharmaceuticals and hormones. In our studies of both public and private drinking water wells on the Cape, we saw the same pattern, where levels with wells with higher levels of nitrate tended to have more emerging contaminants. They had higher levels of things like pharmaceuticals. And so the nitrogen levels, or nitrate specifically, can be a useful marker for us in drinking water. Nitrate itself is regulated in drinking water because at high levels of exposure, it can be harmful to infants. It can affect the binding of oxygen in their blood in infants that are have formula made with contaminated water. But at lower levels, even say a tenth of the federal drinking water standard, that nitrate can be a marker to us of the presence of these other contaminants.
Of course, that's not going to tell you exactly which other contaminants are there. And if it's something like the flame retardant foam that we were just talking about, that might not be the right indicator, though, right? That's not something that's necessarily coming from our septic systems.
Absolutely. It's not a perfect marker because, as you say, there can be other sources of these fluorinated chemicals, such as the firefighting foams. We've also seen in several private wells that landfill leachate may be a source of the perfluorinated chemicals and pharmaceuticals, but not so much for nitrate. On the flip side, nitrate does have other sources, such as fertilizers. So it's not a perfect relationship, and it won't necessarily tell you exactly which chemicals are present. But nitrate is tested in all public water supplies, and it's something that private well owners often test for as well. So it's readily available information, and it certainly can tell us if we see a well that's, you know, 10 times above background levels, that there's some sort of human impact. So it's a good marker for us to maybe do some additional testing or take steps to better protect that water.
Tom, that's one simple measure that people could get their hands on to learn about their own water. But where do you find that information? How would a homeowner find out what the nitrate level is for the water that they're getting?
Well, there's a number of different places, Paula. There's the water suppliers send out consumer confidence reports on an annual basis. They're required to do that. So you can get a first look, see at the range of nitrogen detections in a water supply. through those. There's also databases that, you know, for the average citizen might be difficult to get to, but they are available online to look at a variety of the different compounds. We have been tracking the nitrogen concentrations in public water supply wells for decades. They're required to test under the Department of Environmental Protection water supply regulations. And so that information we'd basically accumulate and look at over a period of time. And so we can basically point out those wells that are over five, and maybe there's four or five of those or six of those on the Cape, and at the the drinking water limit is 10. We've had a long-standing nitrogen loading standard for Cape Cod at 5 parts per million, and this was a compromise that was made back in the late 70s, early 80s. If we were going to continue to develop and be here on and use our aquifer in a sustainable way, that there would be some impact, and that we would need to keep that less than 5. And if we look at our methodology for that, it's been largely successful. As I said, over 60% of the water supplies on the Cape, if we look at nitrogen, are less than 1 part per million. Well, actually, it's less than a half a part per million. So that's been very successful. So, there's a lot of information on nitrogen, and basically that's where we learned about the occurrence, the fate, how it works, and basically transferred that knowledge to the whole coastal water quality issue that became evident in the mid-80s and early 90s, that our drinking water protection strategies for nitrogen, although met those goals, fell short of protecting the ecological integrity of our coastal water bodies.
Jeff is giving us a call. Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. So I want to ask a question. What about the fish?
Good question. Let's see here. And Amy, what we talked about this a little bit. You said mostly looking at water levels. Are fish being looked at all? And how much of a concern is that at this point in our region?
Yes, fish are being looked at, but mostly in other regions. There haven't been any targeted studies that I'm aware of in Cape Cod Bay or Nantucket Sound. I think most of the first studies to look at this looked at wastewater impacted, usually freshwater, because that would be, it's an easier area to study. And they did find, I think Laurel mentioned that some of the impacts on fish, from reproductive impacts to more cancer to feminization of the fish. So there have been documented effects of these contaminants on fish.
And Laurel, does eating fish that are in these areas, should that be a concern for anyone in terms of human health impacts?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we don't really have a lot of information about the accumulation of emerging contaminants in fish tissues. There are some contaminants that are quite water soluble, and those tend not to be chemicals that accumulate up the food chain. We think about things like mercury or PCBs, that as you go up the food chain, the levels increase. And then there are other chemicals that do have that property of increasing up the food chain, but they tend not to be so water soluble. They tend to end up in sediments. So there's sort of a middle range of contaminants that are most likely to accumulate in fish or in oyster. And at this time, we really don't have enough information to assess the health effects of consuming fish relative to other sources of exposure.
All right, Jeff, thanks for your question about fish. Our phone number here at Living Lab is 866-999-4626. Amy, while we're on the topic of seafood, you've been looking at the levels of these kind of contaminants in oysters. What kind of levels are we seeing? And, especially given the emphasis that's been placed recently on perhaps using oysters to help remediate water quality issues, is there a concern there?
So that's probably one of the key reasons why we started looking at oysters, because of their potential role in wastewater cleanup. And we did some preliminary testing in the fall of 2014 we placed oysters in sites that our previous testing had showed contaminants of emerging concern was in the water. So we put these oysters at these sites to see if they would then bioaccumulate these contaminants. Now, bioaccumulation is different from biomagnification. Bioaccumulation is the contaminants are found in the tissue. Biomagnification means that it's passed on up the food chain. So we only looked at bioaccumulation. I can't speak to the fact of whether or not they do pass it on up the food chain. And we did find some contaminants. I believe we found 6 different ones in all at extremely low levels, lower than we found in the water, pretty much. For example, we found nicotine in some of the oysters, but I know. In order to get the amount of nicotine in a cigarette, you would have to eat 50,000 oysters. So you're pretty
much, most of us are not at risk there,
right? Some of the other contaminants we found were DEET, caffeine,
really?
Right? So it wasn't. We didn't find the ones that I thought we would find. So, for example, some of the more persistent ones like carbamazepine or sulfamethoxazole that we find pretty consistently in our water samples, we didn't necessarily find in oysters, which could mean several things. Either they're not taking them in at all, or they're taking them in and passing them through, or they're taking them in and metabolizing them into something else. So what the oysters' impacts on these contaminants, we're not clear on that yet, whether they're actually helping clean them up or whether they're just passing them through.
Laurel, another thing that you've been looking at Silent Spring Institute is eco-toilets, or alternatives to the standard toilets and septic or sewage systems that we tend to have in place. How effective could some of these other options for wastewater treatment be in terms of keeping these chemicals from actually getting out of our houses into groundwater and then back into our drinking water?
That's right. So eco-toilets are one of the approaches that are being considered as part of the Cape-wide wastewater management planning. Rather than going ahead and sewering everywhere, which is a strategy that's not that's very expensive and doesn't make sense in particularly less developed areas, eco-toilets are one option for reducing the amount of nutrients that get into the groundwater. So again, most of the nutrients in our wastewater come from us. And so rather than having the wastewater from our toilets mixed with all the other wastewater in our homes, it does make some good sense to separate those sources. And so we've been doing a study in partnership with the town of Falmouth to evaluate eco-toilets as ways of diverting certain emerging contaminants. So the town is testing septic system wastewater before and after residents put in eco-toilets in their homes to evaluate how well they divert nitrogen and phosphorus. And we've been doing some measurements of pharmaceuticals and hormones and consumer product chemicals as well. It's a study that's still underway, but we would anticipate that pharmaceuticals and hormones that primarily get into wastewater from excretion have some potential to be diverted. And so that would be an added benefit of using eco-toilets. Other chemicals like the perfluorinated chemicals that come from nonstick and stain-resistant products, or chemicals found in detergents or cleaners, probably would not be diverted.
Because they're going down sink drains, not through the toilet.
Right. Right. They'd be in what we call the gray water. So water from our sinks and washing machines and drains.
That's Laurel Shader of the Silent Spring Institute. Also, Tom Cambereri of the Cape Cod Commission and Amy Costa of the Center for Coastal Studies. We'll talk more about contaminants of emerging concern in Cape Cod waters after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests are Tom Cambereri, Watershed Management Director for the Cape Cod Commission, Amy Costa, Director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, and Laurel Shader, Research Scientist at Silent Spring Institute. We're talking about contaminants of emerging concern, things like medicines or household cleaners that get flushed down the drain and end up in the environment and sometimes back in our drinking water. Laurel, before the break, we were talking about oysters and eco-toilets as ways to perhaps prevent these contaminants from getting out of our houses into the environment. What about just a sewer treatment system? Do we know how septics and sewage treatment handle these chemicals and how much they let through or how much they trap?
So wastewater treatment plants and septic systems are not specifically designed to treat emerging contaminants. They're designed to remove solids, to remove the total amount of organic matter, and to deal with pathogens. Some emerging contaminants break down fairly readily, and so they will be removed in septic systems or in wastewater treatment plants. Others are more persistent, but tend to stick to particles more, so they can end up in the sludge. And then other chemicals don't break down that readily, don't tend to stick to sludge, and those are the ones that are mostly discharged into the environment. In terms of the levels that are released, that depends to some degree on the level of treatment in the wastewater treatment plant or in the septic system. So, for instance, in wastewater treatment plants where the water spends more time in the treatment plant, you do tend to see better removal of certain contaminants because there's more time for the bacteria in the treatment plant to break down those compounds. In septic systems, there's kind of two stages to treatment in a septic system. So one is a septic tank where mostly the solids settle out and grease and oil float to the top. You don't tend to see too much removal in septic tanks, but in septic system leach fields, you do see that the bacteria in the leach field can break down some of these emerging contaminants. Now, if your septic system is failing or if it's a cesspool or kind of an older design, you'll see poorer removal of these contaminants. And there can be modifications to the design of septic systems that can increase the removal. There's been some work at the Alternative Septic System Test Center at the base that have shown that if the leach field lines are a little shallower and that wastewater is mixed in with the root zone, that you do tend to see better removal of certain pharmaceuticals because there's more microbial activity in those soil zones. Nevertheless, even if you have advanced on-site treatment or an advanced wastewater treatment plant, some of these emerging contaminants will still be able to make their way through and end up being discharged into the environment.
Tom, towns across the Cape have been trying to get a handle on various wastewater treatment issues, but the Cape Cod Commission also has a regional wastewater management plan that was approved by the EPA earlier this year. How does that plan interact with the town plans? What's in that regional plan?
Well, Heather, that's the 208 Water Quality Management Plan update. And the plan basically looks at this issue of nitrogen overloading our coastal waters. So we have over 100 coastal embayments. Over 50 of those are sensitive and overloaded from nitrogen and suffering consequences. And it's been recognized by the towns and the state and commission that some actions need to occur. And when we look at the one of the, let's say, fundamental responses to how to get the nitrogen out, it would say, well, let's just stop all the wastewater from going into Cape Cod. And that is a astronomical price that would in regards to an infrastructure project of over, let's say, $6 to $8 billion.
Well, and where would the wastewater go if it didn't go back into the ground on Cape Cod?
Well, exactly. That plan, let's say, is dead on arrival. That is basically what the Cape Cod 208 Water Quality Management Plan was about, is taking a look at a broad reach of technology. So Laurel was just talking about the ecosystem toilets and that, but we've identified over 40 different technologies. Some of the technologies, like Amy was talking about, is potentially aquaculture, taking out the nitrogen right in the water column of these embayments. So looking at the watershed, the nitrogen that comes into the watershed, what are the opportunities for removal? So when we talk about, the wastewater issue in regards to plants and that, only 15% of our wastewater right now is treated and it goes into the ground. The other 85% is minimally treated through septic systems, and is going right into our ground. So we do have this major water recycling project happening right now on the Cape, is that we're drawing the water out, we're using it, and it's going back in. It's having some consequences. We've looked at drinking water issues. We are now focused on the coastal water quality issue, trying to restore the ecological integrity of these surface water bodies. And we are looking at not so much these major plants, and I guess, you know, the 208 plan, when it looks at CEC issues, we're looking at the risks of where treatment facilities, if they were part of a town's plan, where they would be located, so they would have the least impact.
Impact in what way?
Well, first of all, we need to keep them out of our drinking water supply areas. So there are
The treatment plants.
The treatment plants, yes. There are some very stringent regulations that actually would allow them to be located in these areas, but they're extremely costly. And so the strategy that makes sense is not so much to pay for putting treatment facilities in drinking water areas and pay a very high price, but to try to locate facilities outside of drinking water supply areas and minimize the concentration actually in the first place. So with the broad embracing a variety of different technologies, that should result in, if we have facilities that are smaller in nature, treating less water.
So you're advocating embracing things like eco toilets or oysters or a whole range of different things, not just septic or not just wastewater treatment plants.
Yeah, permeable reactive barriers as well. There will be areas that will need to have collection systems. We know that these are areas that are fairly dense where it may make sense, but we're looking to do that in a smart sense with the towns. And as we say, you know, this is a regional plan that looks at providing a broad range of solutions, and we're working with the towns as each of the towns are developing their watershed management plans.
Laurel, obviously it would be ideal to try to keep all of these chemicals, the pharmaceuticals, personal care products, detergents, what have you, keep them out of the environment and out of our water supply, but it sounds like technologically that's not necessarily feasible at this point. So what kinds of technologies do we have on the drinking water end to at least make sure that we're not consuming these chemicals if we're worried about them?
So just as in wastewater treatment plants, where the type of treatment affects the extent of removal of contaminants, it depends. At a drinking water treatment plant, there are a range of technologies that can be used to treat drinking water, and some will do a better job of removing emerging contaminants than others. Many of the water suppliers on the Cape adjust the pH of the water, because the groundwater on the Cape can be quite acidic. That really won't do too much for removing emerging contaminants. There's also some water suppliers do disinfection, such as adding chlorine. And chlorine is a very reactive chemical, and it can transform or change the chemical structure of emerging contaminants. So in some cases, they will appear to be removed, which looks like a good thing, although they may be simply transformed to their chemical cousin, and we may not know anything about the health effects of those transformation or the byproducts of those transformations. And there are also filtration processes that can remove emerging contaminants. Tom mentioned in Hyannis that the Hyannis water system has installed activated carbon systems to remove the perfluorinated chemicals that are coming from the firefighting foams. So some emerging contaminants are removed using activated carbon, and these are the same. Activated carbon is also found in household filter pitchers or solid carbon block filters. So at the household level, these can be removed as well. In terms of deciding whether a water supplier is going to put in these types of treatment systems, right now these emerging contaminants are not typically regulated. So until there's a guideline value that's exceeded, oftentimes water suppliers, won't feel the need to put the treatment in until there's sort of a documented concern in terms of health effects. So in the absence of these kinds of guidelines, it makes sense to look at nitrate or other markers of wastewater impact and do what we can to keep the wastewater out of the drinking water as much as possible.
And what about in our homes? What kinds of actions can each of us take individually to both limit the amount of these chemicals that are getting out into the environment? I mean, one caller called and asked, you know, should we be washing Teflon pans separately? Are there things we can do every day to try to limit how much of this we're putting out into the environment and also how much is coming back in?
Well, we think about at the household level what people can do in terms of purchasing fewer products with potentially harmful chemicals. And that has benefits not just for our water quality, but also exposures in our daily lives. So, for instance, avoiding buying stain-resistant coatings for upholstery or carpets if we don't need that. We can also think about maintaining our septic systems. So if your septic system does a better job of removing these contaminants, if it's functioning properly, and not dumping harmful chemicals into your wastewater or directly on the ground either, because either way, those chemicals can make their way into the ground. But it can be a challenge right now to know what products to avoid. Oftentimes, we don't know which products contain harmful chemicals, and many of these chemicals aren't tested thoroughly for safety before they go into production. So it's not reasonable to think that people are going to go to the grocery store and have a long list of chemicals to avoid in the products that they buy. So ultimately, the long-term solution is chemical regulation reform to more thoroughly test products for safety so that we can avoid these extremely persistent chemicals like fluorinated chemicals or others that pose toxic health effects.
And to that point, the House passed a bill earlier this year. The Senate passed a different version just this past week, trying to reform our federal laws regarding chemical safety. Do you think we're moving in the right direction there?
I hope so. I think that the outcome will depend on how the House and Senate Conference Committee try to put those two bills together. I think there are promising advances in both the House and Senate bills.
What kind of advances do you see there?
Some of them have removed some of the barriers for that have blocked EPA from doing more assessments of chemical safety. But there are also concerns, for instance, about whether states can act ahead of the EPA in terms of regulating contaminants. The final outcome of that bill is still in question in terms of whether it will be an improvement or not.
Amy, we have just about a minute left. I know this is an area that you and Laurel and you, Tom, are all going to be continuing to look at. Can you give us a sense of some of the research that you're trying to pursue and the questions that you're trying to answer?
We'd like to continue testing for more sites in Cape Cod Bay and Nantucket Sound. Our testing so far has been somewhat limited by finances. It's extremely expensive to test for these types of contaminants. We'd also like to revisit the oysters to figure out if they do, in fact, purge these chemicals that we are finding in their tissue and how long it takes them to purge, which could be really important information if they are, in fact, used as a wastewater treatment strategy. And also to look at different types of contaminants. We've only concentrated on the hydrophilic contaminants, and we would like to look at the more persistent hydrophobic contaminants in oysters as well.
Lots of questions to pursue. We will definitely revisit this topic again. Amy Costa is director of the Cape Cod Bay Monitoring Program at the Center for Coastal Studies. Tom Cambereri is watershed management director for the Cape Cod Commission. Laurel Shader is a research scientist at the Silent Spring Institute. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Heather.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Elsa Partan and Heather Goldstone. Jenny Junker answers the phones. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and by the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.